Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Crooked Path to Abolition, Abraham Lincoln and the Anti-Slavery Constitution, by James Oakes. Read by Bob Sauer. Preface. In early 1861, on his long meandering journey from Springfield, Illinois to Washington, D.C., President-elect Abraham Lincoln stopped in Philadelphia on February 21st and gave a couple of brief but revealing speeches. By then, 6 slave states had seceded from the Union, a union Lincoln was determined to hold together. At Independence Hall, inspired by the place where his country had been founded, Lincoln could listen to those breathings rising within the consecrated walls where the Constitution of the United States and, I will add, the Declaration of American Independence was originally framed. Lincoln believed that, taken together, these 2 documents, the Declaration and the Constitution, stated plainly the bedrock principles of the American nation. In one of those biblical allusions at which he was so adept, Lincoln swore an oath, "May my right hand forget its cunning, and my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if ever I prove false to those teachings." It was not mere separation from Great Britain that had inspired the revolutionary generation, Lincoln told his listeners that day in Philadelphia. They were aiming for something higher, something in that declaration giving liberty not alone to the people of this country, but hope to the world for all future time. It was that which gave promise that in due time the weights should be lifted from the shoulders of all men, and that all should have an equal chance. This, Lincoln declared, is the sentiment embodied in the Declaration of Independence. Now, as he faced the dismemberment of the Union, he wondered, "Can this country be saved upon that basis? If so, I will consider myself one of the happiest men in the world." But what if the Union could only be preserved if Americans reneged on the promise of equality bequeathed by the founders? Standing in Independence Hall, the soon-to-be President of the United States made one of the most startling statements of his career. "If this country cannot be saved without giving up that principle," Lincoln declared, "I would rather be assassinated on this spot." As unflinching as it was, Lincoln's firm commitment to fundamental human equality did not make him an abolitionist. He never called for the immediate emancipation of the slaves the way most abolitionists did. He never denounced slaveholders as sinners and never endorsed the civil or political equality of blacks and whites. He never claimed, as some abolitionists did, that the Constitution empowered Congress to abolish slavery in the states, nor did he agree with other abolitionists that the Constitution was a pro-slavery document. He never opened his home to fugitive slaves on the Underground Railroad. He endorsed the voluntary colonization of free blacks long after most abolitionists had repudiated colonization outright. He never joined an abolitionist society, but he did join the Springfield branch of the American Colonization Society. He certainly spoke at colonization meetings and temperance meetings, but never at an abolitionist meeting. Lincoln supported due process rights for fugitive slaves, but he never endorsed outright defiance of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 and never denounced it as unconstitutional. Where abolitionists often publicized slavery's most gruesome features, the whippings, the sexual abuse, the brutal destruction of slave families, Lincoln rarely referred to such things. He was repelled by what he saw as the stridency of so much abolitionist rhetoric. As Eric Foner has said, Abraham Lincoln was not an abolitionist and never claimed to be. But Lincoln always hated slavery as much, he once said, as any abolitionist. Like the abolitionists, Lincoln openly attacked slavery as a social, political, and moral evil. If there were differences between anti-slavery radicals and anti-slavery politicians like Lincoln, there were also substantial overlaps between them. Most abolitionists understood that in the end the problem of slavery required a political solution, and so they quite often framed their arguments in careful legal and constitutional terms, terms they generally shared with anti-slavery politicians. Like Lincoln and the Republicans, abolitionists considered themselves the heirs of the founders, the generation that had set in motion the abolition of slavery in the various states. Abolitionists worked hard and with remarkable success to formulate what I call the Anti-Slavery Project, an agenda, a series of specific policies that were designed to stop and then reverse the expansion of slavery, policies that would, as Lincoln later explained, put slavery on a course of ultimate extinction. By the 1850s, abolitionists had succeeded in restoring the problem of slavery to the heart of American politics. They were now part of a vast and increasingly powerful anti-slavery movement, a coalition that embraced the majority of Northern voters. That coalition, known as the Republican Party, constituted the left wing of the American political spectrum, and its most successful spokesman turned out to be Abraham Lincoln. He was certainly much closer to the left than to the right. Conservatives disputed Lincoln's reading of the Declaration of Independence and often denied that it was linked to the Constitution. By the 1850s, defenders of slavery not only distinguished the two documents, but sometimes went so far as to dismiss entirely the principle of fundamental human equality. Northern Democrats who were indifferent to slavery, led by Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, read "All men are created equal" as "All white men are created equal." But for abolitionists, Republicans, and Lincoln, the Declaration meant everybody, men and women, black and white. It meant that, at the very least, everybody was entitled to be free. It also meant that the promise of universal freedom was embodied in the Constitution. Early in the 20th century, historians began to argue that there was a vast gulf between the soaring ideal of human equality so eloquently proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence and what they believed was the more conservative, elitist Constitution. Even today, historians disagree about whether the principle of fundamental human equality represented a revolutionary new ideal or a hypocritical fantasy in a society that tolerated slavery. Are the inspiring sentiments of the Declaration's opening passages belied by a Constitution that recognized and protected human bondage? For the majority of Northerners living in the middle of the 19th century, most of whom disliked slavery, the answer was no. Parse every clause of the Constitution, peer into the minds of its authors, and you may never find the anti-slavery document revered by so many ordinary men and women, black and white, all across the North. But like the slaves who preferred the Book of Exodus to the Epistles of St. Paul, or the radicalized British workers who had their own notions about the rights of Englishmen, Northern farmers and artisans gave their allegiance to a constitution that was unrecognizable to the slave power. Theirs was a popular constitutionalism, though not lacking for hefty scholarship, and millions of its adherents elected one of their own as president in 1860. Lincoln once likened the Declaration to a picture, the Constitution to its frame. For him, as for most anti-slavery politicians, the men who drafted America's founding charter in the long summer of 1787 had committed the new nation to the principle of fundamental human equality. 50 years later, the great abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison would burn the Constitution in public, vehemently denouncing it as a covenant with Satan, a pro-slavery atrocity. But the majority of abolitionists didn't believe that, no anti-slavery politician believed that, and neither Abraham Lincoln nor the people who voted for him believed it. For him, for them, the Constitution was an anti-slavery document. Why, Lincoln once asked, did those old men about the time of the adoption of the Constitution decree that slavery should not go into new territories where it did not yet exist? Why did they declare that within 20 years the African slave trade by which slaves are supplied might be cut off by Congress? What were these and other acts but a clear indication that the framers of the Constitution intended and expected the ultimate extinction of the institution? For Lincoln, the anti-slavery Constitution made itself felt by its practical consequences, by the various acts of the founders and the justification for similar acts undertaken by their descendants. Even in our own day, politicians commonly claim that the policies they advocate are grounded in the Constitution. But Lincoln lived in an age of constitutionalism, as the scholars call it, when every major issue was debated in constitutional terms. Was the treaty for the purchase of Louisiana constitutionally sound? Was the Bank of the United States constitutional? Could the federal government constitutionally support internal improvements, what we would call infrastructure projects? No other issue provoked as much protracted constitutional wrangling as slavery. What power did the Constitution give Congress to regulate slavery in the territories? Did Congress have the constitutional authority to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia? Did the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution grant slaveholders a broad right of property or a narrower right of recaption? Did the Constitution grant extraterritorial protection to masters wherever they went with their slaves? Or did slaves who stepped outside the limits of a slave state instantly acquire the privileges and immunities guaranteed by the Constitution? And what exactly were those privileges and immunities? When the Constitution was ratified, nearly everyone agreed that Congress had no power to interfere with, that is, abolish, slavery in a state. This had been true under the Articles of Confederation, and it continued to be true under the Constitution. Historians call this the Federal Consensus. But the same principle protected abolition in the states. Congress had no power to interfere with emancipation in states that had established the presumption of freedom. This, too, raised a number of contentious constitutional questions. Could a state where freedom was presumed guarantee the rights of due process to men and women accused of being fugitive slaves? Did masters forfeit their slave property when they voluntarily carried their slaves into northern states that presumed freedom? And how far did that presumption of freedom extend? Did slavery follow the Constitution when Southern masters migrated westward, or was freedom the normal condition of the territories? Did slaves acquire constitutional rights in U.S. territorial waters? Over time, it became increasingly common for slaveholders to threaten secession if the northern states continued to deny Southern masters the rights they believed were constitutionally protected. But threats of disunion only succeeded in raising another series of explosive constitutional questions. If a state seceded from the Union, would its masters forfeit their constitutional right to recapture their fugitive slaves? If states where slaves were defined as movable property went to war with the Union, could federal armies constitutionally confiscate that property as contraband of war? Could President Lincoln, acting on his constitutional war powers, emancipate confiscated slaves? Indeed, was the Emancipation Proclamation unconstitutional? Abolitionists developed compelling answers to all these questions. They narrowed down and sequestered the Fugitive Slave Clause, deeming it a singular, limited exception to the general constitutional rule of freedom. They colonized various clauses of the Constitution, the Preamble, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the Fourth, Fifth, and Tenth Amendments, for anti-slavery purposes. And from this anti-slavery constitution, they developed the Anti-Slavery Project. Even abolitionists agreed that the federal government could not abolish slavery in a state, but it could suppress the slave trade, protect the rights of fugitive slaves, abolish slavery in Washington, D.C., ban slavery from the Western territories, and deny admission of new slave states into the Union. Such policies were made possible by the anti-slavery Constitution, the one Lincoln believed was created by the founders. But something had gone wrong. Somewhere along the way, a slave power had wrested control of the federal government and thrown the nation off its ordained course. The intellectual depth and popularity of anti-slavery constitutionalism were no match for the disproportionate power exercised by slaveholders in Congress, the presidency, and the Supreme Court. The goal of anti-slavery politics was to defeat this slave power and put the federal government back on the right track to adopt policies that would, as the abolitionist William Jay put it in 1839, ultimately exterminate slavery. By the 1850s, anti-slavery politicians were using the same language. Thaddeus Stevens called for the final extinction of slavery, and William Seward its ultimate extinguishment. Lincoln would put slavery on a course of ultimate extinction. That, they all argued, was what the founders intended. At some point in the decades-long debate over slavery, every side claimed to be faithful to the intentions of the singular group of men they called the Founders. Who were these people? If, in the 1780s, the state legislators in Pennsylvania, New York, Connecticut, and Rhode Island qualified as founders, we can say that a majority of them clearly intended to put slavery on a course of ultimate extinction. But the same could hardly be said for their counterparts in the legislatures of Georgia and the Carolinas. The ambiguity remains if the founders include only the delegates at the 1787 Constitutional Convention. No doubt some of those men intended to perpetuate slavery, and some intended, or at the very least expected, slavery to die. When it comes to the problem of slavery, as with many other issues great and small, it is simply not possible to discern a unified group of founders whose intentions can be readily discerned. That didn't stop people, years after the Constitutional Convention adjourned, in the heat of national debates over slavery, from ascribing implausible intentions to the founders. When the pro-slavery Senator John C. Calhoun claimed that they intended to maintain an equilibrium between slave and free states, he was making it up. So was Supreme Court Justice Roger B. Taney when he asserted, as a truth too plain to be disputed, that the founders expressly recognized a constitutional right of property in slaves. They did no such thing. But Lincoln was also stretching it when he said that the founders intended to put slavery on a course of ultimate extinction. Some did, and some didn't. It may be that the intentions of those who produced the Constitution are irrelevant. It may be that what matters is the original meaning of the text itself. Distinguished legal scholars whose job it is to interpret the text have given us ingenious, even brilliant, but alas, very different readings of what the Constitution actually says about slavery. It's not that the text is irrelevant. It matters that there was a fugitive slave clause and a three-fifths clause in the Constitution. Scholars disagree about how much those clauses mattered, but no one denies that they did. Indeed, together, those two clauses might well be considered the bricks and mortar of the pro-slavery Constitution. The one guaranteed Southern slaveholders the constitutional right to recapture slaves who escaped to states where slavery was abolished or was being abolished. But there was tremendous dispute between Northerners and Southerners over exactly what sort of rights the Fugitive Slave Clause created, who should enforce them, and how they should be enforced. The Three-Fifths Clause was no less pro-slavery, and its consequences were substantial. If it is not entirely clear whether one or two slaveholders were elected president by virtue of the South's increased influence in the Electoral College, there is little doubt that the Three-Fifths Clause gave the slave states enough extra votes in the House of Representatives to alter the outcome of the Missouri Crisis and to secure the passage of the Indian Removal Act, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, and the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. Here was the pro-slavery Constitution, and it mattered. To be sure, these pro-slavery victories always required the votes of a minority of Northern senators and representatives. If it was never sufficient to sustain the federal power of the slaveholders, the Three-Fifths Clause was always necessary. But there was also an anti-slavery Constitution, and it too mattered. Congress was granted the power to make all needful rules and regulations for the territories, and for decades after ratification, hardly anyone doubted that this authorized the federal government to ban slavery from the territories. Excise that right from the text, and it's hard to imagine the restrictions on slavery in the Northwest Territory and the bulk of the Louisiana Purchase, the protracted debate over the so-called Wilmot Proviso that would ban slavery from the Mexican Cession, or the violent response to the Kansas-Nebraska Act. In fact, without the territorial clause, it's hard to imagine the Republican Party. Similarly, the Exclusive Legislation Clause gave Congress the power to abolish slavery and the slave trade in Washington, D.C. That constitutional power was another source of contention between slave states and free states. Then there was the familiar assertion that the principle of fundamental human equality was embodied in the Constitution. The text itself proved the point, or so slavery's opponents believed. Doesn't the preamble state that the purpose of the federal government was to secure the blessings of liberty, and wasn't liberty one of those natural rights to which everyone was equally entitled? Similarly, the Fifth Amendment declares that no person could be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. How is that different from saying that all men are equally entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? At the very least, it was a plausible inference based on the text that the principle of fundamental human equality was embodied in the Constitution. As with the Territorial Clause, it's hard to imagine anti-slavery politics without the Due Process Clause. The fact that the Fugitive Slave Clause was located in Article 4 implied that the states could require due process rights for accused fugitives, which the northern states immediately proceeded to do, to the consternation of the slave states. By the 1830s, opponents of slavery increasingly invoked the Fifth Amendment to claim that accused fugitive slaves were entitled to their day in court. By the 1850s, it was a commonplace of anti-slavery politics that Congress would actually violate the Fifth Amendment if it so much as allowed slavery into the territories. Taken together, these various clauses added up to the anti-slavery Constitution, based on the text, and hardly the figment of the anti-slavery imagination. Long before the Civil War, anti-slavery constitutionalism was the conventional wisdom among millions of Northerners, not to mention a majority of the Northern representatives in Congress. And yet, when the Constitution was ratified, there was no such thing as pro-slavery or anti-slavery constitutionalism. Both developed over time, and by 1820 the two competing interpretations of the Constitution were substantially elaborated during the protracted debates over the admission of Missouri to statehood. It is a mistake, then, to think of the pro-slavery Constitution as original and the anti-slavery Constitution as a latter-day invention. The two constitutions emerged in reaction to each other, and they continued to develop through the last decades of the antebellum era, each side solemnly invoking the text produced by the founders. But the text will take us only so far. Throughout the decades-long debate over slavery and the Constitution, some of the most contentious issues arose over constitutional principles that cannot be found in the actual wording of the Constitution. Nowhere does the Constitution state that Congress cannot interfere with slavery or abolition in a state, yet it was widely agreed that it could not. Nor does the Constitution expressly recognize a right of property in man, notwithstanding the later assertion by Justice Taney that it does. These two particular absences profoundly shape the debates over slavery and the Constitution, despite the fact that they refer to principles that are nowhere to be found in the text. Given that the Constitution was the handiwork of men who disagreed about slavery, it is hardly surprising that it could be, and was, read as both pro-slavery and anti-slavery. Even today, scholars disagree over whether the compromises of 1787 produced a constitution that was fundamentally pro-slavery. My own view is that, depending on which clauses you cite and how you spin them, the Constitution can be read as either pro-slavery or anti-slavery. And yet, scholarly debates over slavery in the Constitution tend toward the tendentious. It has been argued, for example, that anti-slavery constitutionalists underestimated the significance of the Constitution's pro-slavery clauses, that they saw ambiguity where there was really no ambiguity to be found. William Lloyd Garrison and John C. Calhoun were right after all. There was a single original meaning, clearly, powerfully pro-slavery, embedded in the text of the Constitution itself. If so, the defenders of freedom, however well-intentioned, were sadly mistaken to indulge the illusion that the Constitution was an anti-slavery document. But anti-slavery constitutionalists replied that their opponents went beyond tendentiousness, that pro-slavery constitutionalists flat out made things up. They read an express right of property in man into a constitution that contained no such right. They made the preposterous claim that the Declaration of Independence proclaimed the equality of states rather than people. They claimed, implausibly, that Congress had no constitutional authority to abolish slavery in Washington, D.C., or to ban slavery from the territories. They claimed, on no textual basis whatsoever, that slavery followed the Constitution onto the high seas, into the territories, and even into the free states of the North. Were they right? Once upon a time, a firm yes or no answer would have come easily to me, but I now think it's a mistake to dismiss anti-slavery constitutionalism too readily. No doubt there was a pro-slavery constitution and an anti-slavery constitution. Both were grounded in the text, in inferences drawn from the text, in legal premises and racial ideologies beyond the text, and in the diverse intentions of the founders who wrote it. But the anti-slavery reading now strikes me as more compelling, and the pro-slavery reading less persuasive than I once believed. Clouding the issue is the fact that the question between them was not simply who got the Constitution right, but who had the power to enforce one version of the Constitution over the other. In the early years of the Republic, the slave states enjoyed the disproportionate political power that flowed from having the largest populations and the richest economies. But as the decades passed, the northern economy proved more dynamic. Its growing cities, its burgeoning factories, and its prosperous farms attracted millions of immigrant workers, and by the 1850s, the balance of political power was noticeably shifting from the slave South to the free states. In a counterpoint familiar to all historians of the sectional crisis, anti-slavery constitutionalists became increasingly aggressive as pro-slavery constitutionalists made increasingly extreme demands for federal protection of slavery. Like interpretations of the Constitution, Lincoln's popular reputation tends toward the tendentious. He was either the great emancipator, a secular saint, the man who freed millions of slaves with a stroke of his pen, or he was a reluctant emancipator, an instinctive conservative whose willingness to attack slavery was held in check by his inability to imagine that black people, once freed, could live as equals among white Americans. Both versions of Lincoln assume he had enormous powers that he simply did not have. He did not free all the slaves with a stroke of his pen because he could not. The idea that he could may be a function of the times we live in. After a succession of imperial presidents, it is sometimes hard to remember that Lincoln lived in a world where the Constitution limited at least as much as it empowered. Here I propose a third Lincoln, one whose commitment to the federal consensus, far more than white supremacy, accounts for his deliberate approach to emancipation and abolition. For anti-slavery constitutionalism was, in many ways, a doctrine of restraint. Abolitionists repeatedly claimed that the federal government had stepped beyond its constitutional authority when it admitted Florida and Arkansas to the Union as slave states, legalized slavery in Washington, D.C., authorized fugitive slave renditions without due process, deployed U.S. troops to assist slaveholders in the recapture of fugitive slaves, or demanded the return of slaves who rebelled on the high seas. When anti-slavery radicals called on the federal government to divorce itself from slavery or insisted on a strict construction of the Fugitive Slave Clause, they did so on the ground that the Constitution should have restrained the government from pursuing a host of pro-slavery policies. But the opponents of slavery were likewise constrained by the federal consensus. Whatever else the federal government could do, the one thing nearly everyone agreed it could not do was abolish slavery in a state. However, constitutional restraint did not mean constitutional impotence. Quite the contrary. At the very least, the anti-slavery constitution empowered the federal government to abolish the Atlantic slave trade, ban slavery from the territories, abolish slavery in Washington, D.C., protect the due process rights of fugitive slaves, deny admission to new slave states, and emancipate slaves in wartime. By some lights, the Constitution authorized the federal government to suppress the domestic slave trade, or at least the coastwise slave trade, and acknowledge the rights of slave rebels on the high seas. In the context of civil war, anti-slavery constitutionalism provided the legal basis for the single most revolutionary moment in the political history of the United States, the liberation of 4 million enslaved Americans. It is therefore crucial to understand how, over the course of his career, Abraham Lincoln came to endorse the same basic principles of anti-slavery constitutionalism embraced by most abolitionists. He denied that the Constitution protected slavery as a right of property. He claimed that all slaves brought into the territories were presumptively free. Slaves who stepped beyond the borders of a slave state were thereby entitled to the rights of due process, the privileges and immunities of citizens, and the right against arbitrary seizure. In 1860, the platform on which Lincoln was elected president went far beyond claiming that Congress should ban slavery in the territories. It denied that Congress could constitutionally...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?